Turn your great idea into a reality with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easier than ever to launch your passion project, whether you're showcasing your work or selling products of any kind. With beautiful templates and the ability to customize just about anything, you can easily make a beautiful website yourself. And if you do get stuck, Squarespace's 24/7 award-winning customer support is there to help. Head to squarespace.com/sosmart for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code SOSMART to get 10% off of your first purchase of a website or domain. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 133. A few months ago, in episode 122, we welcomed government and politics professor Liliana Mason on the show to help us make sense of tribal psychology. In that show, we discussed how tribalism is a basic human drive and how it takes very little to encourage us to think in terms of us versus them. Those tribal tendencies can scramble public discourse and derail many of our best efforts at progress, from science communication to elections to our ability to converge on the truth and go about the grind of building a better democracy. In short, we established that humans value being good members of their tribes much more than they value being correct, so much so that we will choose to be wrong if it keeps us in good standing with our peers. In this episode, we welcome Liliana Mason back on the program because her new book on this topic just hit the shelves, and in it she goes into great depth discussing a central idea: our conflicts are over who we think we are rather than reasoned differences of opinion. The book is Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. And personally, I feel like this is just about the most important thing the social sciences are studying right now. And I think Mason is one of the most brilliant of these scientists. And I promise the insights you're about to hear will change the way you think about politics, tweeting, elections, and arguing with people on the other side of just about everything. And this will be one of those episodes where we just sit down and have a conversation. And with that, let's pick her brain. First of all, just tell me, like, what encouraged you to go so far as to put this into a book?
So this actually started off as my my doctoral dissertation in 2009. So this has been in the works for a long time. And in fact, this was 2009 was like the, you know, hope and change year. It was Obama's first term. It was Obama's first year. This stuff wasn't all as frothy as it is right now. but I came to, you know, I was looking at sort of all these different identities, thinking about partisanship, thinking about polarization. And then there was this argument between these two political scientists, Alan Abramowitz and Morris Fiorina, that was going on and sort of had been going on for 10 or 15 years. And they were arguing about whether or not Americans are polarized. They sort of kept throwing, you know, descriptive statistics back and forth and saying, you know, well, if you measure it this way, they are, or if you measure it this other way, they're not. But they kept talking about Americans being polarized in a way that meant that they disagreed with each other about what the government should do. So they had different issue positions. And that's what they both meant when they said polarized. And I was looking around and thinking about, what I was seeing in politics and thinking, well, maybe they don't have to disagree in order to hate each other, right? That we have all of this social psychology literature that talks about intergroup conflict, and almost none of it is about disagreement, right? Most of it is about just groups hating each other. So I started thinking, what if we start thinking about partisanship in that way, as an intergroup conflict problem, and using that literature that, you know, historically has looked at racial intergroup conflict or other types of intergroup conflict, but apply it to parties. So that's sort of how the project started. And then, you know, gradually over time, the things in the world started happening that started confirming these ideas that I have.
Great. There's something that you bring up that I put it down and I'm like, I'm going to say this to people everywhere and bring it to their attention. And that's dinner parties used to be where you avoided politics. And now we find ourselves talking about politics at dinner parties as the norm. Like, we expect that we're going to have a little jam session where we're going to say, hey, do you think this is crazy? Yeah, me too. Or, hey, do you think these people are stupid? Yeah, I agree. If you could speak to that, like, that's, to me, that feels like a great indication of something that's changed.
Yeah. So it used to be that politics and religion were the things you don't talk about at a dinner party, because you don't want to offend the people who clearly are going to, you know, obviously are going to have different positions than you at your table. And that assumed that you were going to be sitting at a table full of people who had diverse political identities and religious identities. And so increasingly, this is sort of one of the major influences that I argue in the book on this increasing sense of partisan dislike, is that we have become separated from each other as partisans, not just in terms of what we want the government to do, but geographically and culturally and in all kinds of ways, so that now the people that we tend to invite over for dinner parties are the people that we agree with. And you're right. Now at dinner parties, there's always that sort of moment when everyone says, okay, let's talk about the elephant in the room. You know, here we go, politics. And that's because everyone tends to agree. And in fact, if you know that there's someone at your table who doesn't agree with you, you probably won't have that conversation.
Yeah.
Unless it's like Thanksgiving dinner. Thanksgiving dinner, you're stuck with your family.
But I'm realizing the Thanksgiving dinner analogy, which comes up a lot in these conversations, comes up a lot because now that's that one time that we don't have, you know, we don't get to sort who comes. Like, mm-hmm. Like it's a throwback to a previous era, and more than it is something that's always been true.
And people hate it. It's like, people dread going to their Thanksgiving dinner because they know that they're going to be forced to have a political conversation with someone who sees the world completely differently than they do.
This also, we do this, the sorting people into our into groups when we decide to go hang out at parties or get-togethers or lunches or dinners or whatever. I know plenty of people who do this on their social media as well. They've carefully over the last year or two just either turned off notifications for the people they disagree with, or they've done this pruning thing where they've removed everyone who believes differently than them politically from their Facebook, and sometimes from their, less so from Twitter, because sometimes I think people want to see what's going on the other side there. But since Facebook feels more like it's our identity, I know people who are like, if you support Trump or if you support Hillary, I'm just going to delete you. That seems strange. And what I'm asking here, is that a function of social media or is that a function of something larger than social media?
I think it's both. And, you know, in terms of the function of social media, it's, you know, possibly these are people that we would not be running into on a daily basis. And so, you know, as soon as you block them, they're just gone. And that's one very easy way to remove conflict from your life. And, you know, add on to this, it's like much more easy to be nasty and mean on, you know, when you're typing than it is to be that way to someone's face.
That's
but
true.
But you know, a lot of this is that, you know, you learn kind of your political story in your world full of people who agree with you, and then you don't really come in contact with someone who disagrees with you until you're in a place like Facebook where you have huge numbers of you know, connections to people who are, you know, third degree removed from you. And those people you can get into an argument with. But you're not very good at it, right? Like, we're not very good at having political, we haven't practiced having political conversations with people that we're willing to compromise with. And so, and also this fact that we have this, you know, very different set of understandings of what is real, that's a major problem for any kind of conversation. So it's partially that it's Facebook. I think it's also just, you know, sort of the political moment is so polarized that we don't really know how to speak to each other with any sense of, you know, common humanity or you know, attempt for understanding.
Yeah. Well, let me talk about, let's get into some of the stuff in the book. I like to talk about this using the term tribal psychology, but I know it goes by a number of different terms depending on which discipline is describing it. And I'm just wondering, what terms do you prefer when we talk about this? Is tribal psychology okay, or is there something that is more specific, that is more illustrative of the concepts from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I have used the term tribal psychology before. I'm kind of moving away from it now because I'm not sure that it's exactly the right concept or communicates the right thing. Essentially what it is just identity. And this is, it can be kind of confusing because the way that, you know, pundits try to talk about identity politics is different than the way that social psychologists and political scientists talk about identity politics. So that, you know, that part can be confusing, but essentially, you know, what this research demonstrates is that everything is identity politics. All politics is rooted in identity. And the more isolated we are from our social outgroups, the more we're going to think of our own group as the best and think of our outgroups as terrible. And so it is this, you know, it becomes this either or, us versus them type of politics. And I think of that, you know, in terms of theory, it's based in social group identity. So I tend to call it sort of identity based politics, which then gets confusing when people say, you know, politicians need to stop doing identity politics, which in my world makes no sense at all, because every single time a politician talks tends to be using some trope of identity that they're, you know, already sort of referring to.
Well, I guess let's briefly separate those. So what is the difference between what pundits say when they use those terms and what people in your world say?
Right. So generally the way that it tends to be used is to say, you are advocating for benefits for one particular, usually marginalized group of people. And so, you know, the sort of way that the thing that they mean by saying that is you're trying to get benefits for this one group at the expense of everybody else. And, you know, the way that I think about identity is, every single one of us has multiple social identities. They, as human beings, our identities affect the way that we think and process information and relate to other people in the world. And we all do it in exactly the same way. And we're all vulnerable to this kind of thinking. So to say that one party or another is using identity politics, it's like, you know, Democrats are constantly using oxygen, right? Like, it's just like, it's a thing that is just universal to human beings. We all do it. And if we just, you know, understood that from the point of view of basic human psychology, then we could understand, what are these biases that we're working with? What are the things that we should be looking out for? You know, what are our vulnerabilities to kind of getting in trouble with this us versus them type thinking? And if we can think about it that way, then nobody is using identity politics, but because everybody is focusing on their own identities and kind of being blind to the humanity of people who are not them. And by focusing on particular groups, when you say identity politics, you make it sound like there are certain groups of people who don't have identities. And that itself is just, you know, on its face, it's absurd if you think about this as just a human psychological process. But also it reflects this, you know, sort of sense of, you know, the white male identity in American politics is seen as the baseline. And so anybody who has neither of those identities or is lacking one of them has identity politics. They do identity politics.
Okay.
And I was actually I was interrupted in a conference at one point when I was talking about identity, and I was interrupted by an older white gentleman who said, "You are a woman. You have an identity. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to be?" And genuinely, there was just this sense of like, I can't have an identity. Obviously, I don't do identity politics.
Huh.
So we're working with that in all of our assumptions. That's part of what I think the punditry are using is that assumption to talk about identity politics. We all have 100 identities and or thousands, but the one that's the most salient at any given moment is the one that feels threatened.
That's so good.
You know, if there are these, you know, groups of traditionally high status people who are seeing other people's status rising relative to theirs, that can feel like a threat. And so they will respond to that by, you know, holding on to that threatened identity much more strongly and gathering together with other people who are in the same social group to try to defend it.
Oh, my God. That's
the basic process.
That is super fascinating. And I mentioned to you before, we had on a previous episode, we had some neuroscientists who came in, and they put people in a brain scanner, an MRI, and they had them they challenged their positions on a number of things. Some positions were like, did Thomas Edison invent the light bulb? And you'd tell them all the reasons why that's not true. And then other things would be about like gun control or something like that. And they found that. I remember when I interviewed them, they didn't understand it, and then after I talked to you, I totally understood what was going on, because they said that for a lot of those positions, people didn't they responded that the brain scanner showed nothing, you know, unusual, but when they challenged them on certain political ideas, their brains responded as if they're being attacked by a bear. That's the actual phrase they used, and I was like, why? And they're like, I don't know. And then it wasn't until I talked to you and read your book, I was like, oh, their identity is under threat. So their selfness is under threat, and their brain's responding like they're actually being, like their body is being attacked because their self is being attacked, which seems strange.
No. This is an analogy that I think about a lot, especially with the bear. I use a lion, but it's the same example, which is essentially, you know, if you're standing in the middle of a you know, prairie or something, and you hear a lion roar, you don't know where it is, and you're all alone, you hide, right? You don't like try to fight the lion, because that would be absurd. But if you're standing in front of a lion and you see it and you hear it roar and you're surrounded by a strong group identity and you see a threat, then you're going to respond with you sort of like get ready to fight. Whereas if you have a weak group identity or you feel sort of isolated and alone, you're not going to respond with such, you know, with such sort of adrenaline. It's going to be more about hiding and being quiet and kind of calming down and listening. And so those are kind of the different ways that people respond to threats based on their level of identification with their group.
Oh my God. Well, okay. So, you mentioned, if we're talking about psychology and social psychology findings, there are two that you talk about in the book that sort of set up a lot of what you have to say. And although we've talked about these previously on the show, they've been years ago, and I think it would be interesting to just sort of briefly pass through them by way of your insights into them and how they connect to your work at large. The first is the Robbers Cave experiment. If you could just sort of briefly take us through what happened there and what that sort of says about the way our brains naturally make sense of things.
Yeah, so this was an experiment done in 1954 outside of Oklahoma City by a bunch of social psychologists trying to understand what makes group conflict. And so they recruited 24 fifth grade boys, and they tried to make sure they were as sort of socially similar as possible. So similar, you know, grades in school, similar family structure, similar physical and emotional fitness. And they brought them to a 3-week long summer camp. The first week of camp, the boys were separated into two different camps. They didn't see each other, and they came up with names for their camps. They called themselves the Rabbits. Rattlers and the Eagles. And then after a week, they were told that there is another camp down the road. And immediately they wanted to meet the other boys and have a competition with them. And so they started off playing a baseball game. And the first thing that happened once they all got into the same field was they started calling each other names. And the ultimately it the conflict extended to the point where the experimenters had to shut down the competition between them because they started throwing rocks at each other and getting violent. So this at this point, so the boys ended up having to be separated by the end of the second week because they were becoming very violent against each other. And not only were they being violent, they started to sort of perceive reality in a biased way. So one group of boys accused the other group of throwing rocks and ice cubes into their swimming hole because it felt a little colder, and one of the boys stubbed his toe. The other group of boys said that their opponents had left garbage on their beach when in fact it had been, you know, the boys themselves, and they'd just forgotten about it. They were asked to do a task where they picked up beans off the ground, and then the experimenters, which who were being the counselors for the camp, placed the beans on an overhead projector and asked the boys to estimate how many beans there were. And the boys always estimated more beans for their own team members, but it was the exact same number of beans every single time. It was the same handful of beans every single time. Huh. So it's a great way of getting at kind of, you know, in little fifth grade boy form, the ways that when you separate people into two groups and they create an us and a them, not only do they immediately want to have a conflict, but they also actually kind of start perceiving the world in a biased way.
Yeah. And we've had evidence for this for going a long way back. I know you mentioned this when you were last on the show, but it's worth mentioning alongside Robert's Cave, the Tajfel experiment.
Right. So the Tajfel experiment was in a lab, much more controlled experiment. And long story short of this is essentially Tajfel, he called it the minimal group paradigm experiment because he gave people group identities that were minimal, that were essentially meaningless. So had people estimate the number of dots they saw and called, you know, half of them overestimators and half of them underestimators, or told them they liked the, you know, he showed them art and then said, well, you are a fan of Kandinsky. And so various different, you know, group identities that they had just learned about right there. They were all alone in the room. They were never going to meet other people who were in their group. And then they were asked to do a money allocation task. And the way that I describe it, sort of the sort of easiest way to describe it, it's not exactly what happened, but this is the principle. Essentially, he said, choose between these two scenarios. Either you, overestimators and underestimators, let's say, both groups can get $5, or your group can get $4, but the other one gets $3. And he was assuming that at this very minimal level of group attachment, there would be no bias against the other group. And he was going to start there and then try to add conditions to see, you know, where does the bias come in? And in fact, what he found was that people consistently preferred to have the win condition over the sort of what I call the greater good condition, where everybody gets the most. Even when they, you know, they had just learned they were in this group, they had never met another group member, and they were sitting there all by themselves, they still preferred to actually spend money in order to beat the other team.
Okay. Now, this is, I think this sets up this crazy thing that we do by default, which is this us versus them thinking, and it can be activated so easily. In Robber's Cave, it's, you know, in the real world, but there's really, you know, these kids were randomly sorted. And then in the lab, in our more controlled conditions, they're given things that are not really identities, really. They've just been handed them, and they're meaningless, and they're alone. And yet still this is introduced, and there's really no baseline. It can be introduced by just about anything. You talk in the book about how we're not only biologically driven to do this, but there are weird biological effects that happen after we do this. I want to go through both of those briefly, in that you talk about cohesion, categorization, and some interesting things that were brought out by Marilyn Brewer's work.
Right. So I think Marilyn Brewer really sort of said it most succinctly when she said, humans have two basic needs, one for inclusion and one for exclusion. And what that means is that we want to feel like we're part of a group. We want to feel included and supported, right? Because what if a lion comes and we have to fight the lion? So we need to feel like we're part of a group. But there is no meaning to the group unless other people are excluded from it. So we want to feel special because we get to be in the group and not everybody gets to be in the group. And if we don't feel like there are people who are excluded from the group, then the whole group itself sort of feels less important to us. So we really need, it's not something that we can kind of just like get over. There is a real, you know, sort of primal drive for excluding people from the group and defining the group with boundaries.
And this need for cohesion, obviously this makes sense in an evolutionary way, just the idea that we have to, you know, we're a group, you know, we're a primate and we form groups, and that's part of our essential nature, and that's how we survive the tooth and nail environment. But we also, from a cognitive psychology standpoint, we have a tendency toward categorization. And you say in the book that it's not just of the outside world, but also of ourselves. How does that work? How do those two elements work together?
Yeah, so this is, this is one of those things where, parenting small children, I learned about the need for categorization. You know, it becomes very important for children at a certain age to say either I'm a girl and I'm a boy, or yellow is my favorite color and it can't be your favorite color. You know, like there's these things that you can really see in young children, and it really is a very basic human thing that we do, is to say, how do I make sense of this whole world of things I see in front of me, right? Which things are me, which things are not me, which things are mine and which things are not mine. Mm. And then how does everything else fit, right? Like, where does everything go? What are the categories that I can make to understand not only all the things in the world, but also all the people in the world? And so you need to figure out, you know, first who you are and, you know, what that means about you, and also understand your relationship to other people. And that, without that sense of categorization, the world feels very chaotic. It's a really important thing that we have to do for our own psychological well-being. Mm. If you can't categorize things, then it's, you know, the world is chaos. So it's not an inherently bad thing that we do. It's just a thing that we have to do to understand the world. This is the way that humans process the amazing complexity of all of the cues that we're seeing out there. But so knowing that, having this sense of, you know, need for inclusion and need for exclusion, essentially what that's saying is we need to be able to say, I'm this, but I'm not that. And without, you know, saying I'm in category A and not category B, that those have to be exclusive categories. Otherwise, we don't have categories. We didn't categorize anything. right. So this is kind of an essential, you know, very, very root, you know, cerebral need that humans have just to make sense of the world. Before we're talking about, you know, conflict or prejudice or anything, this is how we start understanding things. At a very young age, this is, you know, the way that children make sense of the world, and we keep doing it throughout the rest of our lives.
Yeah. And what really, and this really shocked me reading your book, is that once we have moved from categorization to groupiness and group cohesion and tribal effects and all these other things, once we are grouped up, there are these very strange biological effects that come into play. If you don't have those off the top of your head, I have them in front of me. But if you do, I'd love you to run through them.
Yeah. So the ones that I can recall right now. In fact, some of them were neuroscientists who discovered them, neurobiologists who discovered them, where they showed someone a picture of a person's hand who was the same race as them, and showed a needle pricking the hand, and the people's brains responded as if their own hand was being pricked. But if the person's hand was a different race, the skin was a different race, they didn't respond that way. Mm. Seeing an out-group member, seeing an in-group member win something or suffer makes a person's brain act like they are suffering, but seeing an out-group member suffer actually activates pleasure parts of the brain.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The people learn in a group learning task, people learn more slowly if they're being observed by an out-group member. Your saliva, you secrete higher levels of cortisol whenever your group identity is threatened, which kind of goes back to what the other neuroscientists were finding. You write in the book that people's brains respond similarly when people are sad. If the person who is sad is an in-group member, but if they're watching an out-group member, they have a more positive emotion when they see that person being sad. I actually know from work I did on another project that when people do mirror neuron research, that when you can put someone in front of a mirror, an actual mirror, and it's a mirror that's been manipulated so that there's a different person's image in the mirror, and when you reach your hand up to touch your face, there's a very highly trained person who does the same thing, and over time you will graft your self image onto the other person, but not if they're of a different skin color. And yet those same effects are completely mitigated if you change the skin color to purple, because there's nothing to grab. There's no sense of any identity for purple people, I guess, for most people. All of this comes together in this to say that this is not conscious. This is not under your control. This is happening to you.
Right. The fact that you can detect, psychological group attachments in saliva, I think, is suggests that this is not something we can control.
And now we take a break from our program for a word from our sponsor. Summer is the perfect time to launch something new, and the Great Courses Plus is the perfect place to do that. With the Great Courses Plus, you can learn from award-winning experts about a variety of topics like human behavior, philosophy, history, science, and more. And with the flexibility to enjoy lectures anytime, anywhere on the Great Courses Plus app, it's perfect for road trips or long plane rides or whatever it is you're out there doing to change the world. They have a brand new course that I highly recommend called The Learning Brain. It's a fascinating look at how we learn so much more effectively when we believe that we can actually learn a subject. Yeah, that's crazy, right? It makes the important point of you aren't always the problem when it comes to understanding something. It goes into how do we make memories, learn languages, remember how to drive a car, what habits we can adopt to learn more effectively throughout our lives, and how do factors like traumatic injuries and stress and mood affect our gray matter. The answers to these questions are merely the tip of the iceberg in the learning brain. You get 24 30-minute lectures in this single course: episodic memory, semantic memory, how sleep affects learning. I can't recommend this course enough because it isn't just a bunch of facts. It's several lectures in there. They give you practical advice on how to become a more effective learner and break bad habits when it comes to learning. And Learning Brain is the perfect course to get started with, or you can check out any of their other fantastic lectures, because today's listeners will get a free trial with unlimited access to watch and listen to the entire library at thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. Sign up for your free trial now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/smart. And now we return to our program. Well, this brings us to things that you specifically talk about. And I would like to run through these. And all of these blow my mind, so forgive me when I go, what, to every one of them. I want to sort of read some of your quotes back to you and have you disassemble them. And I think all of these are just worthy of writing on a blackboard and walking by every day and putting into your collection of things that make the world make sense. One is, we act like we disagree more than we actually do. What do you mean?
Yeah. So that's kind of the title of the book, right? Uncivil Agreement. The example that I would give today, sort of to be, I guess, politically salient today, is to think about like child separation at the border, right? So, you know, I would suspect that 99% of Americans would say children should not be separated from their parents. But when you get a partisan cue attached to it, you can actually get people to say the opposite thing that they would have said, you know, 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Similarly, you can convince people that their party holds a different position than it does, and they will change their position immediately, without even knowing that the party gave them the cue, and they'll think that it all was, you know, coming from their own logical reasoning process.
We have research that shows that specific thing, right?
Yes. Yes, an experiment by Jeffrey Cohen from 2003 changed the welfare positions of Democrats and Republicans, and people they matched their own position to their party, and were asked, you know, did your party have an effect on your opinion? They said no, and they were asked to write an essay about it, and they broke down a whole bunch of reasons about why they held that position. So they came up with them, you know, out of whole cloth, on the spot, not knowing that this was something that they were even doing. So, the statement that we act like we disagree more than we actually do kind of reflects this sense of our opinions can be very fluid, and so fluid that if we wanted to come to a compromise, we could, if there were not these pesky identities in the way.
Oh, wow.
But we can't come to a compromise because our identities are making us want to take positions as far away from the other side as possible. And so what that means is that we are trying to look like we disagree in order to defend our identity and our sense of, you know, difference from the other people. But that actually isn't the case. And another example that I give in the book is that, you know, right after the Sandy Hook shootings, Pew did a study and asked people the extent to which they approved of the government creating a background checks law for gun purchases, and something like 90% of the entire American population agreed, including 80-something percent of Republicans agreed that there should be legislation enforcing background checks. And then they were asked, you know, do you approve of Congress passing a bill that would enforce background checks? So almost the same question, but this is now Congress actually doing it. And Republican support for that dropped by 20%. So only 50-something percent of Republicans then supported the bill itself. So, you know, 80-something percent supported the actual thinking about the law, but only 50-something percent supported the bill. Which essentially means when it comes to party victory in the government, people have different opinions on what they want done than when it comes to actual policies on the ground. So plenty of people would be happy for a law that enforces this policy that everyone agrees with. But the people who are on TV would say this is a big loss for that party. They don't want to deal with that. They don't want to deal with the idea that their party lost on something, and so their approval of the legislation is diminished. So those are two different things. What our actual opinions are and our actual level of agreement is different than what we are willing to accept our government to do because we don't want to feel like our party is losing.
Okay, and I feel like just this last. These last few answers you gave really should illuminate for a lot of people listening what's happening. Like every time I go to Twitter and then it has that prompt, it's like, well, what's happening? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. And there's this sense of like, how did the world go crazy? Are we all poisoned? Is, you know, social media destroying our minds? Why can't the other side listen to me? Are they in a cult? Both sides think the other side is brainwashed or it's in a cult or something. Mm-hmm. Because what your work and the work of some other people in your field is suggesting is that these are, you know, psychological, the environment is changing and it's affecting our psychological responses to the environment, which then causes the environment to change even more. And we're sort of in this weird feedback loop right now where, there's something out there cause partisanship to increase something. There's a million variables that caused that to happen, and polarization began to occur. But then once psychology, our innate human psychology, locked into that, it started driving that polarization. Is that a fair reading?
Yeah. Well, and in fact, I would argue that one of the more powerful things that drives it has been this, you know, sort of the identities that are connected to our parties becoming more separated. So our racial identities and our religious identities are being separated by party, so that you know, when I said before, we don't want our party to lose. If your racial and your religious identity is connected to your party identity, then you don't want your racial, religious, and party identity to lose much more strongly than you care about just your party identity. So it's that our parties are taking up an increasingly large portion of our sort of self-concept real estate, and so the stakes of the game are much higher now than they were, you know, 50 years ago.
Is there any consensus on how that's happening? I know that the sort of folk political science idea is that it was secularization or something to that effect, that people used to, their identities were tied to religion, or they were tied to there's also the idea that we used to be tied to our local geography. You know, we were members of our town first, and then, or we were members of our subdivision and then our town or whatever you live in. and then, you know, national politics was almost something that we thought about, you know, on the side or on the back burner, or in relation to our local politics. Is there any consensus as to what is why we've become, you know, Republicans or Democrats first, or libertarians first, or whatever you are first, and then all these other identities second? Is there any consensus in political science as to why?
Well, so there's a couple of different major things, I think. The first was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, after which we had a bunch of Southern Democrats very gradually leave the Democratic Party, because party ID is has always been a very strong identity. It's hard to switch parties, right? It's like converting to a different religion. Most people don't do it. And so after the, you know, conservative Southern Democrats, you know, really disliked the Civil Rights Act that their party had enacted, they didn't just become Republicans. They sort of slowly, gradually moved away from the Democratic Party, and then the next generation could identify as Republican. So that took a generation, and that's really what we saw happening during the 1970s and 80s, when there were a lot of cross-cutting identities, and that there was low polarization then, because people weren't sure exactly which party they belonged with, because it was in the middle of this process of kind of realignment. And then the second thing that happened is that the religious right really became involved in politics in the 1980s, and the Republican Party, you know, I'm not sure which direction it went, but the Republican Party and the religious right decided that they were meant for each other, and they really started working together. To the extent that by the year 2000, essentially all of the requests of the Focus on the Family, I think it was, or no, sorry. Man, what was it? I forget. Oh, Contract with the American Family. So all of the platform requests of the Contract with the American Family, which was sort of the Christian coalition platform, were included in the Republican Party platform by the year 2000. So that also sent a very strong signal to voters, you know, which party is your party. And those were social changes that happened. And essentially what it did was send racial cues and religious cues to the voters to give them additional information as to which party represents you the best. And it's much easier information to understand than, you know, who likes taxes and who likes welfare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes a shocking amount of sense. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
But of course, that was facilitated by also this increasingly partisan media. So not only did we have much easier cues because they were racial and religious, but we also had a partisan media that was telling us exactly which the cues were and what we should be, party we were supposed to belong to and who we were.
So it's feedback loops on top of feedback loops. In the actual world itself, mm-hmm. you've got these parties who are slowly incorporating things that are already identities, and then that causes people to move more into the party, and then it makes it more, it sorts and sorts and sorts, and then the media just wants to make money, so it's responding to the marketplace that's changing, and it then becomes another driver of that marketplace. And then you've got human psychology that's that is groupie psychology that is responding to all this, that's causing it, that's then driving it more. It's like three feedback loops causing a perfect storm of feedback.
Yes. Yeah. It's it is kind of the perfect storm.
Great.
And plus social media, right? So, and then we have social media on top of it, where we just start yelling at each other for being bad people.
Oh yeah. And social media today, I feel like is like 98% tribal signaling at this point, or whatever terms we want to use. Because it's what drives engagement. Facebook. It's not in Facebook's interest to make people engage with their platform less. So that's why they're so really squirrely about all this.
Well, and it's also not in the news media's interest to explain how policies are going to affect the electorate at large, rather than to say which party won and which party lost this legislative vote. And that's sort of the story of that, of the background checks bill, is that you know, the way that it's portrayed in the media is to say these are the winners and these are the losers, and then everybody watches because they want to know if they won or they lost. But if they say this is the bill, these are the details, this is how many, you know, people it would help, this is how many people it would hurt, these are the things that you need to know, no one's going to watch that.
That's on C-SPAN.
It's really. Yeah, it's super boring.
And nobody watches C-SPAN.
But if it's like, nobody watches C-SPAN. But if it's who's the winner and who's a loser, and you're in one of those groups, then you're going to pay attention.
Yeah, and I've seen that, like, there's a sort of it bleeds, it leads aspect of modern cable news, which is instead of it being somebody was, you know, shot or there's some weird thing that's happened in your local community, it's always presenting whatever is happening in politics as an us versus them thing, as someone winning and losing, as can you believe what this person said about this person? It makes total sense that someone who was adept at and was steeped in the tabloid reality television version of entertainment to rise up in a landscape like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Is this right? Recently there was a news article saying, is this, you know, are the tariffs a win for the president?
<it's> right.
Like, well, tariffs aren't, who wins democracy, right? Like, and that's ultimately the question. And there shouldn't be like one half of the country wins democracy type of answer to that question.
Yeah. Well, this leads to something that you talk about in the book, which is, as you know, as the nation grows more partisan, there's this idea of the other that is just everywhere. Where whoever you are, whatever group you're part of, the idea of the other is something that that has become, you know, omnipresent, and it's something that candidates in every era, since there's been politics, since we wore togas, it's something that candidates can easily tap into, and there's a sense out there, I think, that people like Donald Trump are brainwashing people, or tricking them, or turning them into hate mongers, or something like that. But I get the sense from your book that Trump, like many before him and many who will come after, it just simply took advantage of the existing political landscape. Is that fair?
Absolutely, yeah. He's definitely not. I mean, I started writing the book in 2009. I had no idea that Trump was coming. So he's definitely an example of this rather than the cause of it. And the thing I like to say about Trump is that, you know, his campaign did two really effective things. One was using the term winning as much as possible. And also admitting that people were feeling like losers, right? He was saying, we're losers. We lose all the time. And that spoke to a lot of people. And then I'm going to make us win again. And then he just kept repeating that word winning. And that, you know, that when we have a polarized electorate, that really gets at this sense of like, I really need to win. And the other thing that he did was point at a target to be the scapegoat for why people felt like they were losers. And so that it goes back to the lion example, right? If you don't know where the lion is, you have nothing to fight. But you feel anxious, you don't know what's going on, and you need to hide. But if you do know where the lion is, and you're told that you're a winner and you feel, you know, surrounded by these other people who are strong, then the, you know, the way that psychology talks about it is that creates a more angry response, which is an approach emotion. You get up and you start doing things like fighting.
Mm.
And so effectively what Trump was able to do was to take all these sort of these people who were feeling vaguely anxious, like things were not going right for them. They didn't like the way that that things were happening in their lives and in the country. And but they didn't know why exactly. And he pointed his finger at, you know, immigrants and Muslims and, you know, whoever else, and said, that's the reason that this is all happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
And now you know where the source of your threat is. Go get it. And so effectively what he did was change anxiety into anger for these people. And anxiety is an emotion that makes you sit down, and anger is an emotion that makes you get going. And so he got a lot of people, you know, revved up, and he effectively made them feel more powerful and you know, like they deserved to be in power.
Hmm. Similar to, as you argue in the book, how, you know, there are these forces that lead to our, you know, intergroup and in-group and weird identity stuff, and then after we're within those groups, there are forces that then act upon us. Something that sort of made me feel bad. It was you said that once someone like this comes into power, anyone who uses this us versus them, winning versus losing strategy on a partisan electorate, once they come to power, that same partisanship then allows them to disregard norms. And then once they disregard those norms, norms are fragile psychological constructs in the beginning, those norms deteriorate. Is that what's happening?
That's part of what's happening. Yeah. I mean, no one feels identified with norms, right? You can have norms of your group, and you can strongly, you know, try to behave in a way that comports with those norms so that you don't get kicked out of the group. But if you feel like, you know, the norms are of another group, then why do you need to worry about them?
Hmm.
And so, you know, there's this idea of Trump coming in and being, you know, draining the swamp and being, you know, this sort of new, you know, starting over type of president. And so those norms didn't really apply to him or his supporters necessarily. And, you know, those were like establishment government norms that they didn't feel particularly bound by because they didn't really identify as, you know, typical establishment, you know, political people. So they really probably had very little, I mean, there was very little recourse to betraying those norms. Generally, the way that we keep people obeying norms is by social sanction. And so, you know, if you violate the norms of your group, then your group sanctions you and you are shunned or punished or something happens, you notice that you've done something wrong. But if it's not your group that's shaming you, then there's very little that can be done to make you pay attention to those rules.
Hmm. Okay. Now I'm super freaked out. So taking everything we've talked about so far, there's something in the book that you talk about, and this is really important, and it's something that it's changed the way I see the world. And you say that with polarization, and you talk about three ideas: polarization, sorting, and ideology. And you say that these have traditionally been seen as something we do based on the issues that we find important. You argue that there is really a second way that groups become polarized, a second way they sort themselves, and a second way that they express or invest in ideology. And I thought we'd just run through those one at a time to sort of see what's driving that second version of things, this second phenomenon. So, and you use these terms, and if you can just like sort of help us understand them, there's issue-based and identity-based. So what is the difference between an issue-based polarization and identity-based polarization?
Right. So the traditional view that sort of when I started my dissertation, the only view of polarization was issue-based. So do Americans, are Americans becoming increasingly extreme in their issue positions and sort of moving to the two ends of the spectrum? So are Republicans becoming extremely conservative and Democrats becoming extremely liberal? That would be polarization. And so the reason that I sort of started this entire project was to say, well, what if there's a different kind of polarization? What if we're not polarized in our issue positions? We hold relatively moderate issue positions, but we're so attached to our identities that we feel very distant from our outgroups, regardless of the issue content. And so, so the issue-based polarization basically means that we disagree, and the identity-based polarization means that we feel like we are very different people from the partisans in the other team, regardless of our actual issue agreements.
Okay. So, and then building on that, what is issue-based sorting versus identity-based sorting?
So sorting is actually was one of the alternative alternative explanations for what was going on. Instead of polarization, it was sorting, because if polarization means that people are becoming much more extreme, moving to the extreme ends of the spectrum, sorting means that it's just that Democrats are becoming consistently more liberal and Republicans are becoming consistently more conservative. They're not becoming more extreme. They're making all of their issue positions on the same end of the spectrum. So it doesn't mean that they're extreme. It just means that they're consistent, which on average would make it look like Democrats are becoming more liberal and Republicans are becoming more conservative. But really, it's just people scooting over to the correct side of the spectrum on all of the issues. So that's the traditional idea of sorting, is that, you know, partisans are learning what goes with what and which positions they should be holding. Identity-based sorting is I also call it social sorting, which is basically this process that I talked about earlier, where the parties become increasingly racially divided and religiously divided, and so, you know, when partisans are looking at the other side, they're not seeing people who are like them. And, you know, to the extent that they are partisans are sorted socially, they're going to find it a lot harder to speak to and to understand and to humanize the people on the other side of the aisle.
And this was when I read this, I thought, how could this possibly be identity based? But obviously it is, after everything we've spoken about so far. But what is the difference between issue based ideology and identity based ideology?
So this is maybe the most controversial one. The word ideology classically means what is your system of beliefs, right? Like, what issues do you hold and how do they fit together? Like, are they, you know, they to be generally liberal or generally conservative? Identity-based ideology is just simply, do you identify with the term liberal or the term conservative, regardless of your issue positions? Because there's research, there's a book by Ellis and Stimson called Ideology in America that talks about how the American electorate on average is what they call operationally liberal. What that means is, on average, Americans prefer liberal policies. But also, on average, the American population is symbolically conservative, which means that they prefer to call themselves conservatives on average. So within the group of people that calls themselves conservatives, there's a lot of heterogeneity in terms of issue positions. And there's a wide range of issue positions that people who call themselves conservatives hold. It's a little smaller on people who call themselves liberal, because liberal was such a bad word for such a long time that you have to commit to it if you're gonna call yourself that. But among people who call themselves conservatives, there is a very wide range of actual policy content. And so if that's possible, then there has to be something about the word conservative itself, separate from the issues that make up the definition of conservatism, that is meaningful to people. And so I started with that and then started measuring, you know, when you talk about liberals, do you say we rather than they? You know, to what extent do you think of yourself as a conservative? How well does the term conservative describe you? And so these are these social identity-based questions. And what I found was that even among people who have completely conflicting issue positions with the label, so liberals who hold relatively conservative issue positions and conservatives who hold relatively left-leaning issue positions, even with people who have the wrong issue positions, the more strongly they identify with the label, the more they hate the other side. So liberals hate conservatives if they're very strongly identified as liberal, even if they don't have the right issue positions. And conservatives hate liberals even if they have the wrong issue positions, as long as they're strongly identified as conservatives. So there is a social effect that's happening with the terms liberals and conservatives that is not entirely related to the content of the policies that go along with those terms.
Hmm. Okay. Well, to me, I look at all this, I think about this, and I feel like I know there's a tendency out there to believe that we're all, you know, driven by ideas. And we're not driven by any of these tribal allegiances or this group psychology or, you know, I don't think anyone wants to believe their saliva changes when they think about this kind of stuff. We want to think that it's the issues themselves, it's the facts of the matter that determine our attitudes about issues and whether or not, you know, and those attitudes determine whether or not we support gun control or abortion or fracking or if we believe in climate change or criticize the president or anything that is now currently oddly divided along party lines. And I think seeing that things like that are divided along party lines should clue you in that something is going on. And reading your book, it seems like you're making an argument that oftentimes collective action, and whether that's voting or protesting or something more than that, and you say straight up in the book that activism is good, you know, this collective action is good. But in the book, it seems like you're making an argument that our collective action sometimes is something we do on behalf of our group more than on behalf of our actual understanding or passion about the issue, or that passion comes from the groupiness. Is that so?
Yeah, so the way that I explain it is we obviously want people to be active in politics. We don't want a completely apathetic electorate. The place that it becomes problematic is when, you know, how I said anger is an approach emotion. So if you just, and the ingredients of anger are generally, you know, this is simplifying it, but tend to be that you feel like you have a strong group around you and you know the source of your threat. So if those are the two things that are contributing to your anger, and you're participating in politics on behalf of that strong group identity and that, you know, finger pointed at whatever is causing the threat to you, then you're going to participate in politics kind of on behalf of that anger rather than, you know, thinking through which party best represents your interests. And, you know, sort of this is what Aiken and Bartels call the folk theory of democracy, that, you know, people sit down and think about, you know, which party is best matched to them and which one best represents their own personal interests and values. And then they, you know, make a reasoned decision, sort of like a banker choosing an investment. But instead, you know, what ends up happening is that we start making these decisions much more like sports fans. So if we're taking action like sports fans, you know, sports fans don't do anything productive, you know, like they're not cheering for their team so that their team can then go like legislate things for their district and like help them get, you know, like subsidies for their business. Like you cheer for your team just to make the team win so the team can win. And then the team wins and you don't expect anything more of them. And you don't hold them accountable for whatever they do after the victory. And so if, you know, if you're participating in politics on behalf of just that, I just need that victory because it's going to make me feel really good because I'm so strong, so much of my identity is invested in this party that I just need them to win. And I really don't care what happens after they win. That kind of activism is not great because essentially what that means is that we will be taking action on behalf of our party and not holding them accountable at all. If they do something bad or wrong or against our interests, we will not vote against them because they're our team. And just because your team misbehaves doesn't mean you stop being a fan of the team. So that type of activism, I argue, is actually normatively not good for democracy. We need accountability. We need an electorate that can hold elected officials accountable when they don't do the things that they're supposed to do. And if we have this sort of team-based approach to activism, then we're not going to be able to have that type of democratic accountability.
People are always asking, how do I change these other people's minds? And just to use like a specific example, like with what's going on the border, which, you know, people may find themselves in an argument with someone who is defending what's happening on the border. And that's just one example of many things which you might find yourself arguing about. And do you have any advice as to how to reach out to people who are in the other side, whatever the other side is for you, and encourage them to see things differently?
Well, so there's two different ways to approach this. One is to try to get, you know, essentially change the subject away from politics like let the temperature of the conversation die down a little bit. Remember that your friends or relatives or whatever you are, you know, go cook a pie together or something, and then come back to it when you're kind of at a more peaceful moment and you can actually talk sincerely. Because if that's the first thing that comes up, then everybody's hackles go up and nobody's going to agree to anything. The other argument that I've seen lately is just if you're talking to somebody who has just a completely different conception of reality than you do, and their source of information is you've never even heard of any of these things before, and they're using arguments that are complete nonsense to you, that's just not, it's almost not a conversation that's worth having. Unless you can get back to that sort of calm moment when you can speak sincerely. But starting off in a place where you're using completely different bases of reality and truth, that's just not a conversation that can really go anywhere. And so my advice would be, don't start it that way. It's like, don't jump into a political argument with somebody before establishing some type of trust and rapport with them, because you're both just going to go back to your camps and use your talking points, and your brain is going to come up with every single reason that you're right and they're wrong, and that's the only thing your brain is going to come up with. There will be no empathy, there will be no thoughtfulness. But if you spend a little time together and then maybe in a quieter moment say, I'm really worried about those kids, or something that's human and thoughtful and just in order to sort of just take it down a few notches and then speak on a human level rather than like, how dare Trump and his administration do, like it's just nothing is going to work as long as it's politicized that way. It has to be a human conversation with your own feelings and thoughts and your own understanding that the other person has, feelings.
That's really, I like this, what you just said, because I think I get into a lot of arguments in which I realize the other person is pulling their information from a source that's hidden from me, and I'm likely doing the same thing. And so we're almost by having a proxy war. And I find that the discussions are better when instead of doing that, the source is introduced up front. Like, this is what someone said, or this is an argument that I've seen somewhere. What do you think of that argument? And now we're like directly addressing a shared thing and we're coming up with our own justifications. And we might still have some kind of proxy war, but I find that discussion is better than the naked discussion, which is like, hey, what do you think about the thing that happened in Russia? And then, we're not actually having a conversation at that point. We're just launching arguments that our team has introduced as the best arguments when you face the other side.
Right, you're just rehearsing your lines, basically.
That's good advice. Stop rehearsing your lines, everyone. Okay.
Put them down. Put the script down.
Please put the script down. That's going to be my main advice from now on. Well, this leads to my last question, which is a big one. And that is, the last time we spoke, I got a lot of emails and I got a lot of tweets, and they all ask the same question pretty much, which was, I don't want to do this. What do I do? I mean, do I join a bunch of different groups? Do I start reading the other side's newspapers? There was that kind of thing. And then I guess there's another kind of question that people would ask, which was the same question, which is, what do we do this as, how do we approach this problem as a society? You say in the book that as long as this social divide is maintained, then we're going to behave more like warring tribes than nations that have, different values and different ideas about what policy should be enacted. And so, and now it's just like this side has to win, this side has to lose no matter what. I feel like they're kind of the same question, which is just what do we do? How do we fix it? And you even have this as a chapter in the book, things that you have identified that we could do now based off our current understanding. I'm just going to stop talking and let you talk as long as you want about that, because I think that is the thing that people want to hear most from you once you have made them feel as bad as I currently feel.
So yeah, the things that we can do, a bunch of the things that I talk about in the book are things that could happen. It's not necessarily anything any individual person could do. So I think probably the most promising thing is having another rift in one of the parties and a new realignment like we had in the 60s and 70s. That's not something we can do. But it's something that has happened before and could happen again. The other things that we're individually responsible for are, you know, one of the things that we know about intergroup prejudice is that we can combat it on an individual level by practicing turning it around. So essentially saying, I just made a snap judgment about this person based on their identity. I realize now that I did that. I'm going to be aware of it, and I'm going to think about it and try to sort of change that snap judgment or that stereotype around in my head and practice thinking about that person as the opposite of the stereotype I just thought of.
Mm.
And over time, you can get good at it. You know, you can practice it so much that it becomes a little easier and it comes a little bit faster. The first immediate instinct is always going to be to go after that person with the first, you know, with stereotypes that are associated with them. But you can create, you know, by practicing, you can create a secondary response which can follow the first one relatively quickly that says, wait, don't assume that. You know, give this person a chance. They're a human being, you know, they have family, they have, you know, they care about people, you know, they're a normal human being. The problem with that is that it requires motivation. So this is sort of where my research is going right now, and it's kind of a more controversial angle at this point, even than I get to in the book, which is who is motivated to do this? And unfortunately, not everyone is motivated in the same way to take these types of actions. In general, it's a lot easier to try to understand other people. It's a lot easier, going all the way back to the original social psychology, Marilyn Brewer research talking about, you know, overlapping identities, is that people who have very homogeneous groups, so, you know, let's say you have a racial and a religious group, and most of the people in your racial group are also in your religious group and vice versa, those are highly overlapping groups. And in that, the people who have very highly overlapping groups tend to be more intolerant of outsiders, people who are not like them. People who have only mildly overlapping groups, so if the majority of people in your racial group are actually a different religion from you, those people tend to actually be much more tolerant of out-group members and much more inclined to try to understand out-group members as human beings. So we have a problem where the people who need to be motivated to do this are already isolated in these very, you know, these very homogeneous social groups. And the more isolated they are, the less they're going to be motivated to try to understand outsiders.
Hmm.
So that's problematic. And it's like the people who need to try the most are the people who are the least inclined to try. In fact, this is where it does get controversial, is that I feel like at this point we have to say there is a party asymmetry here. And I've seen this in Desire to Compromise. I've looked at this from the 2016 American National Election Studies data. I've seen this in Desire to Compromise in, you know, feelings towards out-group members. And what I found is that, you know, people who are largely in the Republican Party, because the Republican Party is largely white and Christian and straight, they tend to be affiliated, or they tend to be socially exposed to other partisans who are very, very similar to them. And it's really relatively rare for a Republican to meet another Republican who is racially or religiously distinct from them.
Hmm.
Democrats are the party of, like, everybody else. So for any given Democrat, you know, Democrats are like 56% white, you know, 19% black, 17% Hispanic in 2016. So for Democrats, any given Democrat is likely going to be exposed to another partisan member, another party member who is racially or religiously distinct from them, because there are plenty of very religious Democrats who are people of color, and there are plenty of very secular white Democrats. So most of the time within the larger party umbrella, Democrats tend to be exposed to people unlike them on a much much more regular basis, or at the very least, they think of other partisans, you know, other people in their party, in their group, as more diverse than you know, just this who exactly that one person is.
Hmm.
Which means that we're going to have this sort of situation where The people who are probably reaching out to you saying, I want to change this, I want to be more tolerant, are the people who are already more tolerant and probably more exposed to people who are unlike them. Not in a partisan way, but in a racial, religious, other types of cultural, geographic, social ways. And so that is something that we're going to have to address at some point. I don't know, you know, I don't really address it in the book, but it is a problem that, you know, saying everyone needs to behave the same way to fix this problem is not exactly correct, because it's the people who are the most socially isolated who really need to practice this the most.
Yeah.
And it's unclear to me exactly how to motivate that. Because that's an extremely threatening thing to say to somebody who feels very comfortable in their homogeneous, socially homogeneous group. And then the last thing that I would say is this, and this is also not individually on us, but if anybody's, you know, thinking about, you know, media and the way that journalism works, you know, to really stop trying to frame everything as a zero sum game, right? It's not good for ratings, so this probably is not going to happen. But to the extent that we describe legislation as a win for one side or the other, we're never going to have compromise. And the only way for democracy to work is for there to be compromise. So we have to somehow get to a point where, you know, ideally the news would say, this is the legislation, this is what it does. The whole Congress is voting on it. And let's see what happens. And then we could watch to see what the outcome of the vote is, and not to see, did my team win or not? And then if they won, great, I'm turning off the TV. I'm not going to pay attention to what happens with that law anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, it would be great if we could have a little bit, you know, different type of coverage of the way that politics works. Because right now we are... You know, we're telling ourselves a story about a war that's going on in our country, and it's only making the war worse. And we need to find a way to step back and think, okay, what's good? What's the greater good? Find a way to think about, you know, how can we look for what's the best for the most people? And that's, you know, obviously it's not human instinct to do that, but there, we've done it before, and, you know, we've had cross-cutting identities between the parties, you know, not that long ago. And it is possible for us to have, you know, cross-cutting identities again that would at least link us to the other side about, you know, in terms of thinking of them as human beings. And then the last thing that I'll say is that the one policy that I've thought of, this is actually since I wrote the book, the one policy that I've thought of that could work would be service. So one way to get people of varying backgrounds to work together is to put them to work together doing some type of service, right? Working in a soup kitchen or building houses for Habitat or working in Peace Corps, doing something, or working in the military, right? Even the military is a giant melting pot of all different kinds of political orientations. And so one thing that might be, you know, that could be helpful is to have, you know, somehow work together. This is, you know, my like blue, you know, moonshot idea. But like, you know, possibly connected to tuition, right? Like free tuition, free college tuition for people, but on the condition that they do, you know, 2 years of service, and then that service is not done immediately right with their neighbors, right? That service mixes them together with other people who are from different places and have different perspectives. And then we would have, you know, a generation of Americans who sees other partisans as human beings and does service, which is great, and gets to go to college, which is also great. So that's my one like optimistic outcome, is if we could do that, then maybe we could have a little bit more understanding.
Liliana Mason is a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, and you can find her on Twitter at Lily Mason, PhD. That's L-I-L-Y Mason, PhD. The book is Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity. That is it for this episode of the You're Not So Smart podcast. For links to everything that we talked about, head to youarenotsosmart.com. For all the past episodes, go to Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, wherever you get podcasts, or youarenotsosmart.com, where you can also find the show notes with links to everything that we talked about. Follow me on Twitter at David McCraney. Follow the show at NotSmartBlog. We are also on Facebook/YouAreNotSoSmart. And if you'd like to support this one-person operation, go to patreon.com/YouAreNotSoSmart. Pitching in at any amount gets you the show ad-free, but the higher amounts get you posters, t-shirts, extra content, signed books, and other stuff. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. And please tell everyone you know about the show. When you're in one of those threads that says, hey, what's your favorite podcast? Mention the show. And check back in about 2 weeks for a fresh new episode. I'm working on some new stuff. It won't be the next show, but it will be soon, about the latest research into fake news, how it's affecting us, how we consume it, why we're panicking over it, and if that panic is justified. Look for that episode soon.